Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 46 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. It's a new year and a new decade, and I'm so happy to be back here with you hosting the Medieval Podcast, which is now officially 1 year old. Can you believe it? We've covered all sorts of great stuff in the past year, and I'm super excited to bring you a whole lot more great content this year. So let's get started, shall we? My first guest of 2020 is the fab and funny Anne Terrio. Anne is the author of many, many articles that stretch across everything from the internet to literary magazines like Quill and Quire to church magazines to more mainstream fare like Flair magazine. But what's really caught the imagination of Anne's fans and followers is her long read series, Queens of Infamy. I caught up with Anne to talk about some of her favorite queens, saints, and foxes, and what it's like to write infamous history on the internet in 2020. Well, thanks for joining me, Anne, to talk about your series, which is Queens of Infamy. I'm so happy to talk to you because I've loved your work for ages. And then we just met and you're just as awesome in person as you are on the internet. So I'm happy to have you. And this is going to be our first podcast of 2020. So welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I wanted to talk to you about Queens of Infamy because although you write all sorts of stuff across different publications, Queens of Infamy is probably what's brought you the most historical fans, right?
Yes.
So what is Queens of Infamy?
So Queens of Infamy is a series on long reads, and each one is, I would say, 5,000 to 7,000 words. So they're quite long, as the name would suggest. And each one profiles a different historical queen from kind of birth to death through hopefully feminist lens.
So when you talk about a feminist lens, what are you talking about when you're coming at history with a feminist lens?
Trying to look at things through a lens that's critical of gender and race and socioeconomic status and power and how women wield power, but also how those women are perceived and how the wielding of power often marks them as unnatural women and that kind of thing.
Yeah, we were talking with, I was talking with Helen Castor a few months ago about that, about how women who are in power are often seen as unnatural even today. And your Queens of Infamy, they go from, well, you have some people from Judea, ancient Judea, to Josephine is the most recent one, I think. Josephine Bonaparte?
Yes.
Yes. So you're covering a whole range of people, but a lot of them are medieval, right? So here's some of the medieval people that you've talked about.
Joanna of Naples and Eleanor of Aquitaine. And I think that might be it for the medieval queens. And there's a few that are like early modern, like Catherine de Medici or Anne Boleyn. But yeah, the medieval early modern ones are my favorite.
Yeah, they're my favorite too. Do you actually have a favorite of the queens that you've talked about?
You know, like I always love Anne Boleyn because we're both named Anne. Actually, there are a lot of Queen Anne's, so it's a good name to have.
I mean, like, what is there not to love about that story as a story? I mean, that's one that you have to really pick apart when you're talking about looking at all the different angles that are like socioeconomic status and feminist theory and stuff like that. Looking at Anne Boleyn, I mean, that's a whole big ball of wax. So how was it to write about her?
I mean, it's tricky because you want to look at how the men in her life have impacted her from kind of her father setting up this very ambitious pathway for her through marriage to, you know, kind of the coercive nature of having a married king fall in love with you. But you also don't want to take away her agency or her ability to make choices. Like, I don't love the narrative that Anne was only a victim. I think for sure she was the victim of a lot of powerful men around her, but I think she also had agency within her life and made some really interesting choices.
Yeah, I think that's the tricky thing about looking at these historical women is so often over time they have been cast in these two different roles. Either they are, you know, vicious women or they're victims. So how is it navigating this when you're writing?
Yeah, I mean, I try to kind of have them as fully fleshed out humans in the same way that when we read histories of men, they're allowed to be multifaceted, I guess.
Yeah, Absolutely. I mean, it's funny because, you know, it seems like that is obvious, but at the same time, it hasn't been, you know, when you're looking at biographies, especially of royal women. So do you find it's difficult to find sources for these royal women, or do you find there's lots of them that you can draw from and then you kind of have to pick and choose? How have you found it so far?
It depends on the queen. I mean, for some of them, there's so many, like Josephine. I mean, there's so many sources. But somebody like Joanna of Naples, there is, you know, one kind of really strong modern biography by Nancy Golden. And otherwise, she's kind of a footnote in a lot of other histories.
Yeah, especially because this is the one who's the sister of Richard the Lionheart, right? Joanna of Naples?
He did have a sister named Joanna, but she was a descendant of Eleanor of Aquitaine, but she was 14th century, like kind of just as the plague was arriving Europe. She gets cast as a footnote in a lot of narratives about the plague because her life and the plague kind of very famously intersected.
That's right. That's right. That's the other Joanna.
Yeah.
Joanna's mixed up. This is the one that had to travel across Europe to get married. And just as she gets married, she dies, right? Or is it just before she gets married? Have I got...
No, I got my Joanna's mixed up.
Which Joanna is it? I should have done my homework.
That's the problem when there's only like a few names that, like, you know, there's so many Joannas and so many Annes and so many Margarets. They're very confusable.
All right, you tell me which Joanna. Okay.
So her father was the king of Naples, and he died without a male heir. And she got kind of strong-armed into marrying her Hungarian cousin. And then he died shortly after, he was murdered shortly after they were married. And she was very strongly suspected of having carried it out, even though she was like 16 or whatever. And then she immediately married her other cousin, who was very hot. and then both the plague came to Europe and the Hungarians started invading Naples as like revenge. So she had these kind of two horrible forces happening, and she kind of slipped out the back door and went to Avignon, where the Pope was. And she had to prove her innocence to the Pope because she was accused of murdering her first husband. And so the way she did this in part was that she walked in a procession through the city, which was plague written at the time, and then at the end of it she kind of said, like, look, if I wasn't innocent, God obviously would have given me the plague, but since I'm still healthy, I think we can all draw our conclusions. And she had a very eventful life. She was married 4 times. She was involved in like the Great Western Schism, and in the end she was killed and her body was thrown down a well in Naples, and it's still there. She never received a proper burial.
Well, that is not Joanna I was thinking of, but that's an awesome story. It just goes to show, you know, when you do medieval studies, it's this huge time period, like 1,000 years, it's an entire continent, and you just can't know everything. So I love to actually learn more stuff, even if it means I have to trip over my own feet a few times getting there. Right. So, yeah, that is a really good story. And 14th century is my favorite century because of all the disasters in it. And it actually makes more opportunities for these crazy things to happen, which I think is great. So one of the other people that you wrote about was Eleanor of Aquitaine, which we are like totally familiar with. But you haven't just stuck to Europe either. You've actually gone to the Middle East. You've actually talked about a really awesome African queen who's early modern. But can you tell us a little bit about her? Because she's amazing.
Yeah. So I'm worried I'm going to say her name wrong because I've never heard it said out loud. But Nzinga, who was queen of what is now Angola. And I think she was 16th century. Now I'm not remembering my dates properly. But yeah, she was a really like fascinating kind of anti-colonial queen who really mobilized people against the Portuguese and was queen for like, I think like 60 years, and maybe not quite that long. and really created and held this independent country against the invaders for quite a long time.
Which is an awesome story. And what I liked about that was that he wanted to get this out so that other people could read it. Because I think so often we are so focused on Europe that we miss other stories. So even though this one is outside of the Middle Ages, this is one I wanted people to know that you'd written. So what brought you to, I mean, you do seem to enjoy the Middle Ages and those queens especially. Mm-hmm. What is it that draws you about this period?
It's because for the longest time when I was really young, the only kids movie my grandparents had on tape was Disney's Robin Hood with the Hot Fox.
Which is something we totally have in common because we both have a crush on this cartoon fox and he was very influential in both of our careers.
And so, which is like kind of a great introduction for kids to the medieval period, I feel. I mean, obviously not super accurate, but like very interesting and engaging and set during a real time period with like a real king. And then also it was weird realizing that, you know, they so often talk about the queen mother in the movie that, you know, Richard is the mother's favorite, but Prince John is, you know, doesn't get his mother's affection, and that's why he still sucks his thumb. And then it's like, well, the mom is Eleanor of Aquitaine. That's wild.
I know. I made my kids sit down and watch this movie, and I was laughing so hard. I hadn't seen it in so many years, and I was laughing so hard because now I know who Eleanor of Aquitaine is, and this Disney movie is the best now.
And then you kind of get all the jokes because you're like, oh, she really did love Richard best.
Like, exactly. Yeah. And how much John loved her, but he couldn't really get her attention. Yeah. Yeah. I love that. And that was what got you into the Middle Ages. Well, me too.
And there's a British writer, Rosemary Sutcliffe, who was very prolific in kind of the mid-20th century, and she wrote historical fiction, YA historical fiction, like extremely detailed and researched, and I was so into her books when I was younger, and I guess still am from like a nostalgic perspective, but I think that also really shaped how much I liked it, because she wrote about time periods, but often they were like these very domestic dramas starring children, and that was really what made me, that's the stuff I'm interested more than like the battles and the that kind of stuff. I like the tiny, like, who was wearing what and what they were eating and what kind of songs they were singing.
Well, that's, you know, that's the stuff I like too. I mean, I like all sorts of that kind of stuff. And I really like to find out how people solved problems back in the day. But it's the day-to-day stuff that most people are involved with in their lives, right? Like, what am I going to wear today? What am I going to do today? Who am I going to see today? And so that stuff's really interesting. And I like that you're saying that, you know, you got into this through historical fiction and Disney and stuff, because because I went to a conference about 10 years ago and somebody was asking people around the table, how did they get into that? And I kind of said, like, I said, Disney. Yeah. And there was like this collective gasp, you know, like you just admitted that out loud. But I think it's getting to be more accepted and more acceptable that a lot of us come to it through historical fiction and a really good looking fox.
Well, and I mean, like, people should be honest. I don't think there's like a lot of kids out there being like, yes, I got into it from reading some ancient Latin texts. And I mean, I think most kids probably get into it through some kind of fiction.
I think so. I think so as well. And so you've come sort of full circle in that. Well, you're not writing for kids. Your articles are not for kids, but you're coming around, just so everybody knows that, but you're coming around to actually feeding back into the public's interest in history. So how did you get this gig where you started to write history for the public? What led to that? Because I think we all have kind of meandering paths. What led to you writing history for the people?
So I was making a lot of jokes on Twitter about historical figures. I think it started with Mary, Queen of Scots. I was making jokes about her second husband's murder and how he how they were just like, weird. It was an explosion. I don't know really what happened to him. Anyway, he's gone. And this editor from Long Reads, Ben Huberman, who is great, reached out to me and said, would you be interested in turning this into a long form series? And I was like, absolutely not. But then I was like, I'll try anything once. So we'll try it and see how it works. And I felt very, I still feel very ill-equipped to do it because I have no formal training in history. But I was like, we'll just, you know, we'll see how it goes. And so it kind of started out as like almost this private in-joke between us. And but other people liked it, which still astounds me.
So that's, there's a couple good points in there that I want to come back to. The first one being, so you don't have formal training. You know that's fine with me. So how do you get around that? Because I do think that there's still an idea that you should have a certain mm-hmm. formal training. You should have certain letters behind your name, but that's not necessarily the best way to get the people into history. So how do you work around that, knowing that you don't have a degree in history? How do you work around that, making these articles as accurate as possible and as accessible as possible? What's your process in?
I mean I read a lot to prepare for them, and then any facts that seem suspiciously well placed, I definitely try to fact check from multiple sources, and then also they get fact checked by long reads. I think a lot of historical sources are out there and available for people if they want them. But the problem is that they're so often dry and people don't really kind of want to sit down and read a very dry text for hours and hours on end. So what I try to do is distill the interesting points and make them funny and accessible. But I do definitely like feel, like I said, out of my league about it because I worry a lot about screwing up or taking up space in a field that's not mine or whatever. And I feel very inadequate. And, you know, often I just feel also like there's rules that I just don't know because I never learned them, like rules on how to research or how to fact check or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's important that you're bringing that up because I think there are a lot of people that have something to say and they get in their own way about it. So we talked about this before, and one of the things I'd have to give myself pep talks when I started to write for the internet was, I don't have to be the best. I just have to be consistent and persistent and actually do my best at this. And I think it's really important that you're saying, like, you have this fear that, you know, maybe you're an imposter, but you do it anyway. It is like, it's a legit thing. I mean, imposter syndrome. Yeah. And it doesn't matter how many letters you have behind your name. Yeah. If you have none, if you have four, it doesn't matter. I think a lot of us have imposter syndrome, but you started putting yourself out there and that's what got it going. And you're still doing that. And it's drawing people. So has that lessened at all?
I think it's actually become worse because when we started out, it was very small. And I thought, like, nobody is going to read this. It's fine. Or like people who don't really know about history are going to read it, but they won't know any different. And now I'm like, oh, lots of people read it and actual historians read it. And like now it has to be very rigorous and accurate.
Yeah. I mean, that was a surprise to me too. When I started to write and actual other historians started to read my work, that was a surprise. And it does really sharpen your skills very quickly.
Yeah.
Because you need to get to be a lot better and make sure that you're really kind of on track and doing that diligent research. So what do you do now? Because you're on social media, you're very popular on Twitter. What do you do when people come after you, when these trolls come after you? How do you handle that? Because I think there's a lot of people that might be afraid to put their own work out because they're afraid of the trolls. And you handle them pretty well. So what's kind of your thinking around trolls when they come at you?
These days, I do try really hard to figure out what is worth a response and what isn't. And most things are not worth a response. They're not criticisms made in good faith or people trying to argue in good faith. And it's just, you know, I've gotten into arguments or long threads with trolls, and it's not worth it because they're not actually listening to what you're saying. And it just almost highlights them and gives them a platform if they respond, which isn't to say that I don't think anyone should refrain from responding from trolls if that works for them. It's just having tried it, I find it doesn't work for me.
Yeah. Do you think that has to do with your personality, that the one that you've put out online? And I do want to make clear that our personalities online might not be the same people that we are when we're in sweatpants. But the personality you put online, do you think that has to do with that, the nature of the way they speak to you? Do you think that has to do with maybe gender? Do you think that has to do with the subject matter? What do you think is bringing this to you?
Yeah, I think, all those things impact who responds to me and how I respond to them. Actually, something I was talking about with Helen Castor when I met her is the kind of impulse that we have as women to respond on social media and be kind and gracious, because I always worry that there's this sense of like, you know, somebody says like, oh, great job, and I don't respond, and they think, oh, like, hasn't this one gotten too big for her britches, like too good to even respond to me, you know? So there is still this really challenging line to figure out how to navigate. But generally, if people are not being great in responses or comments, I always just try to tell myself, like, you know, it's very hard to read tone online, and maybe this person is just having like a very bad day and they're cranky and being silly, and just ignore it.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean about you seem to have a good attitude on Twitter, because you don't get into huge scraps with the trolls. You seem to know when to engage and when not to engage, and when it is not worth your time. But I think about the same thing as well. Or, you know, I might be really busy and I've seen something on Twitter, but I don't have time to respond to it. And then I think, mm-hmm. Oh no, people are going to think I'm not being polite, or I'm like above responding to them, when there could be a whole bunch of reasons.
Yeah.
Not to mention the fact that, you know, life is busy. It really is. So do you have plans to continue writing for long reads? And your next one is Mary Magdalene, isn't it?
Yes. Although that one's not for long reads. That one is for Broadview, which is a church magazine, which I guess fits for Mary Magdalene. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to be funny or irreverent, but I mean, hopefully it'll disrupt some long-held beliefs we have had about Mary Magdalene.
And it's disrupted some long-held beliefs that you had about Mary Magdalene as well. So what are some of the things that were kind of surprising to you or exciting to you when you're doing this research?
Well, I didn't know that the kind of sinful woman sex worker story hadn't started until the 6th century, and it was Pope Gregory the First, who began it during, I think, a Good Friday homily, and then about a year later, another homily, where he just kind of connected all these different parts of the Gospels that have no actual scriptural connection, and was like, okay, well, when this sinner woman appears with her alabaster jar and she's anointing Jesus, and she doesn't have a name, but I think we all know that she's actually Mary Magdalene, and I think we know that she's a sinner because she like sleeps with a lot of people. And I think we know that the oil in her alabaster jar is like used to anoint her private parts. And it's like, ooh, yikes. Like
that's a lot of assumptions.
Yeah. And I was, most of my religious education was Catholic. And so I don't think I read the Bible as much as some. So I relied heavily on the myths.
Well, I mean, how many of us, honestly, growing up in the Sunday school tradition, went and mm-hmm. looked at it to find, like, where is the evidence for this? I don't think many of us did. Right. You know, they said Mary Magdalene was a lady of the night, and we all just accepted it. But, you know, you, as you say, if you look in the Bible, well, it's not immediately obvious. Someone has drawn those dots for us. And then her story really evolves in the Middle Ages as well, doesn't it? Like, it's crazy.
Yes. There's like a lot that goes on with like stories about how she grew hair all over her body and turned very furry, and also like went to France and lived in a cave and became a hermit. And there's like a whole lot of really fascinating mythology that built up around her. And then during the Counter-Reformation, it was very popular for artists to do pictures of her, because that was kind of the one naked lady art that the church would allow wealthy patrons to have. So everyone was kind of like, yeah, like, give me those pictures of Mary Magdalene.
It's true. And I did see something that you had on Twitter where you're showing, like, we can show pictures of the Madonna, and she's half naked, and we can show pictures of Mary Magdalene and she's half naked, and this is acceptable. And well, and you know, we laugh about it, but it's funny how our standards for what you can put in religious art are different mm-hmm. from the Middle Ages. And in those days, they didn't think it was irreverent necessarily right. when you had this kind of a picture. I mean, I learned about the myth of Mary Magdalene from my friend and professor's Joanne Finden's book on the Digby play. And that's, you know, the story of Mary Magdalene going to France and being all Mary and stuff like that. And I think that, you know, if we look at some of these religious texts from the Middle Ages, we might go like, oh my gosh, that's appalling. That's so sacrilegious. But they saw things yeah. differently back in the yeah. day. So when you're researching this kind of thing, do you find you have to make sure that you're putting on a different lens for how you're looking at it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, anything religious is very weird because, well, anything Christian is very weird. I don't really know a lot outside of that. But because the Bible as a text is so contested and at times problematic, so you're kind of like never sure what is even kind of the root reality.
Yeah. Yeah. Which text is the root text? And I think that's really important when you're looking at history and religion and yeah. all that. And it's been so influential if you're talking about Europe, especially.
Yeah.
Christianity. What is the source text we are using and which translation? And it makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
And Mary Magdalene isn't the only saint that you've written about. You wrote about no. another favorite saint of yours, which is Saint Dimphna. So we talked about Saint Dimphna a little bit when I was talking with Keisha Tracy about disability. But who's Saint Dimphna and why is she important to you?
She was a 7th century Irish saint. She was the daughter of a king, and her father was pagan and her mother was Christian. And her mother died when she was 14. And right before her mother died, she decided to consecrate her life to Christ, which was, I guess, fine with everybody in her family. And then her mother died and her father went mad with grief and kind of in his madness decided that he was going to marry his daughter and that was the only thing that was going to make him happy. And that was obviously appalling to Dimphna, and things got so bad that she decided to flee. So she and her confessor fled from Ireland to Flanders, to what is present-day Belgium. And according to some versions of the myth, she used some gold she'd brought with her from Ireland to build a hospice, and some versions of the myth even go so far as to say that it was a hospice specifically for madmen, which would have been very unusual at the time. But because she was spending all of this Irish gold, which I guess was very recognizable, her father was able to easily trace her. So he followed her to this town, Giel, and asked her again to marry him. And she refused and he beheaded her. And one of her, or I guess her first miracle, was that 5 men from her hospice witnessed her beheading and were immediately miraculously cured of their madness. So she, over time, developed kind of as this local saint and then eventually became the patron saint of mental illness. And the town where she died became this pilgrimage site for people with mental illness.
So her story is a really important yeah. one. I love it. I actually really like her story. And it hits, you know, the more saints' lives you read from the Middle Ages, the more you can kind of recognize what's going to happen, what the steps are.
Yeah.
And hers is very conventional in a lot of ways, but it's also a really interesting one because, well, patron saints all have different things that they are the patrons of. And she is very much the patron saint of mental illness, and people are still going to that area, not necessarily looking for a cure, but looking for understanding there as well. And you've been there as well, haven't you?
Yes. Yeah. I was there last year. Actually, coincidentally, the day I got there was her feast day. So out of her death, there sprung up this program that eventually was taken over by the state psychiatric board. But that's this very radical, non-institutional model of community psychiatry that still is going on today. So it was neat because I got to go to the hospital and like talk to the archivist there. And it's also funny because they're all kind of very skeptical about the religious angle. Like he was saying that he gets people calling him up all the time, mostly from North America, asking if he can like send them some holy water or
yeah, well, these roots go deep, right?
Yeah.
So how was it writing about a medieval saint? Was that something that was comfortable for you? Was it something that really kind of stretched you as a writer? Like, how was it to write about a medieval saint?
It was really neat. I would say it definitely took some stretching. I mean, I felt like, I was going to say I felt like I knew the time period pretty well, but I didn't. I mean, it's very early medieval, and I don't know Belgian history at all. I know it a little bit now. But I knew the history. I knew the history of psychiatry pretty well. I mean, what was challenging was sifting through stories, because her story wasn't written down until the 13th century, I think. So there's quite a long gap during which it was just kind of an oral tradition. And so writing about it, there was kind of a lot of hedging of like, well, some people say this and some versions of the story say that.
Yeah. And yeah, again, it's like you say, like finding the origins is a difficult thing to do, especially with stories. So in the future, you're going to keep writing long reads.
Yes.
About queens. You're going to keep writing about queens. You better, because now you have a t-shirt out, which is amazing. Everyone should get one.
Yeah, I have merch now.
It is an awesome t-shirt and I need to get one. So do you have any idea of which queens you might want to look at in the future? Are there ones that kind of are calling to you right now?
I mean, I always love the French queens, or like the English queens of French birth, because I mean, that's a history and a society I feel pretty comfortable with exploring and making fun of, because I'm French Canadian, so I feel like it's allowed. But and they're always like the most dramatic and have the most like bonkers, like, how is that real kind of stories.
Yeah, I do like French queens as well. Like, I was talking when I was talking to Helen Casser about her book She-Wolves, we didn't get into Isabella of France, but she might be my favorite, because wow, what a story. Yeah. So if you write about that, I'm gonna read the heck out of that, because it's gonna be awesome. Well, I want to thank you for talking to me about Queens of Infamy and about writing history for the people, because I think it's a really important thing to do, and I'm glad you're doing that. Do you have any final thoughts about writing history for people, or people that want to do what you're doing on the internet right now?
Yeah, I think just that it's okay to make it engaging and interesting, and it doesn't have to be rigorously academic as long as you have all of your facts in place, that it's kind of, there's no shame in being funny and like adding silly gifs and like, I don't know, I've seen people make fun of, you know, these kind of history threads that have reaction gifs or whatever, and I'm like, whatever, you know, if that's what gets people into it, then so be it, like, who cares, like, let people enjoy things.
Yeah, exactly. I remember talking to Dan Jones about this, and he said, we don't want to be the fun police. We don't want to be the fun police. We want people to enjoy history.
Yeah. I agree.
As much as we got into it when we were watching this Disney Fox.
Yeah. The Fox that launched 1,000 ships.
I know, right? Thank you so much, and it's great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
You can find Anne's work as well as her wit on Twitter by following her at Anne_Terrio. In true Canadian fashion, that's Anne with an E _ TheRiault. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalists.net to tell us what's on the website. What's up, Peter?
Hi, Danielle. Welcome to 2020.
Thank you. I'm having a good year. Are you having a good year?
Yes, I have, and the website has, because we've had a lot of great posts that have come in from our writers. First, we have a piece on medieval films that involve time travel. So that's a lot of fun. There's a new theory about what happened to Norse in Greenland. There's your piece on heraldry, which I really enjoyed. And you can also look for a couple castles for sale that only will cost you a couple hundred thousand euros.
Oh, yeah. No problem. No problem at all. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
2019 was a great first year for the podcast, and that was thanks to all of you listeners who made it possible with your likes, shares, and last but definitely not least, your patronage. Patrons of the Medieval Podcast can find awesome stuff like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare magazine, our book club with Boyd Allen Brewer, and an ad-free version of Medievalist.net on our Patreon page. You can check it out at patreon.com/medievalists. For all the best medieval content, you can follow medievalists.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Sobalski, trading Robin Hood gifts with Anne Terrio on Twitter at 5minmedievalist or 5minutemedievalist. And you can find me on Amazon too, where my latest book, Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, is now available worldwide. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening. I hope you're having a wonderful new year.